All right. Thanks, everyone. Good afternoon. I'd like to start by acknowledging my co-authors of this work, Cora DeBeck, Enoch Simo, Thomas Curran, Evan Wood from the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS. I completed my training there and now am an assistant professor at Brown, and this is Vancouver-based data that I'll be presenting today. None of us have any conflicts of interest or relationships to disclose. So I'm going to be talking about gang involvement today just by way of an introduction and to provide some U.S. context and comparisons to this Canadian data. This is data from the National Gang Intelligence Center. They monitor gang involvement in the United States, concomitant with an ongoing recession and increasing social and economic inequity in the United States. The center has observed increasing expansions of criminal street gangs and proliferating gang membership, particularly among urban young people. According to this most recent report in 2010, there are approximately 1.4 persons involved in gangs in the United States, primarily in the urban centers of Chicago and in Los Angeles and other surrounding counties. Notably, though, the largest increases in gang memberships are in the northeast and southeast part of the country. This study took place in Canada, which is 2.5 hours north of Seattle and has since 2008 been known as Canada's gang capital. The city is rated as one of the most livable in the world. It's known for its beautiful surroundings and high quality of life. But it is also the center of a major gang war driven primarily by drug trafficking between the United States and Canada. This figure shows the locations of a spat of murders that were gang-related occurring in 2009. You can see the homicide rate here, 1.42 per 100,000 in 2009. I note that this in Canada was considered a crisis. This is approximately 10 times less than the homicide rate in the city of Boston last year. So there were gang murders in the center of Vancouver and in the suburban regions of the city. And this led to a number of papers, lots of public attention brought to this crisis. It gave the city of Vancouver the moniker Gangland, Canada's Gangland, and a number of press on some of the leaders in the gang activity in the city. The Bacon brothers led the United Nations gang, named because they took on members from any ethnic group, taking on the UN name. There were also public health campaigns that are ongoing to prevent gang initiations among young people, including this one run by the City of Vancouver called Teens Against Gangs, or TAG, which is a video contest and public service announcement for young people. So in addition to the established violence outcomes associated with gang involvement, there have been a number of other public health adverse public health outcomes associated with gang membership among young people. These include other delinquent behaviors, criminal activity, obviously, increased rates of alcohol and substance use as well. There has been some literature around increased rates of unintended pregnancy, STIs, and sexual victimization experienced by both women who themselves are involved in gangs and also women who have male partners involved in a gang. And finally, traumatic stress symptoms as well, following both current involvement in gangs and then exit from gang membership. So the objective of this study was to inform some local ongoing public health campaigns to prevent gang membership in the city of Vancouver, and also to examine some relationships between self-reported gang involvement and early childhood traumatic experiences and other ongoing factors and characteristics in a study of drug using street-involved youth in Vancouver, Canada. The data for this analysis comes from the At-Risk Youth Study, or ARISE, which is a prospective cohort of street-involved youth. Eligibility for this study included being between the ages of 14 and 26, which defines a young person in Canada, and recent use of an illicit drugs other than or in addition to marijuana, and the provision of informed consent. Participants complete an interviewer-administered questionnaire every 6 months. For this particular study, it was actually cross-sectional. We used data collected from interviews conducted between June 2009 and May 2011, so just during and following that heightened gang crisis in Vancouver. If a participant completed more than one interview, we simply took data from the first interview that was conducted during this period. Our main outcome variable was self-reported response to the question, have you ever been in a gang? Yes, no. We also looked at a couple of secondary outcomes, which I'll provide some data on, including ever being approached by gang members to become involved in their activities, and also reporting gang affiliations in one's social network, so having friends in gangs. We were interested in a number of independent variables. This included sociodemographic characteristics like age and ethnicity. Ethnicity in this context is defined as Aboriginal ethnicity, First Nations, Métis, equivalent to American Indian versus other. And I'll show you data from that. And we focused on early adverse life events reported by participants. This included a history of being in government care, which included, for example, being a ward of the state or spending time in foster care or orphanages, reporting ever dropping out of school, and then reporting a history of early childhood sexual or physical abuse. In order to compare some of the data that has been coming out of the United States, we also wanted to examine relationships between more proximal factors and gang involvement in this sample. So we looked at recent reports of drug dealing, incarceration, and then also perpetuation of and both experiencing or being a victim of physical violence. And we used log binomial regression to calculate prevalence ratios. All of the data I'm going to show you is stratified by gender, so we have male and female specific prevalence ratios. So we had 435 participants who completed a survey during the study period. The mean age was 22, a little bit higher than we were hoping for, but reflective of young people living on the street in Vancouver. Approximately a third were female, and almost 20% were of Aboriginal ancestry. Approximately 3% of the entire Canadian population is of Aboriginal ancestry. So you can see the great overrepresentation of Aboriginal people, youth living on the street. Just under half reported having a friend currently in a gang, versus around a third reporting themselves being ever approached to be in a gang, and 22% reported some kind of their own lifetime experience by being involved in a gang, and that's going to be our primary outcome for the rest of the analyses I'll show you today. So these are the results for the males, 290 people in total. Overall, males were significantly more likely to report gang involvement, 26% of these males ever reported involvement in gangs, versus only 14% of our female participants. You can see here the prevalence ratios plotted for each of our covariates of interest. We saw an increased prevalence of gang involvement among Aboriginal male participants compared to males of other ethnic groups. We also saw that males who reported a history of involvement in government care were also almost twice the prevalence of gang involvement compared to folks who did not report government care. And we were also able to corroborate previously identified relationships between current correlates and gang involvement. That included recent drug dealing, recent experience of incarceration, and also the perpetuation of physical violence. Each of these variables were associated with a 2- to 3-fold increased prevalence of gang involvement among males. I'll turn now to the female-specific effect estimates. We did not have as many females in our sample overall and fewer females reporting gang involvement, so you'll note that the confidence intervals are fairly large here, reflecting low power to identify effect estimates in these models, unfortunately. You'll see, however, we did pick up a couple of significant associations. Females that reported a history of sexual abuse in their childhood under age 18 were significantly more likely to report gang involvement in their past, and females also who experienced physical and violence recently were more likely to report gang involvement as well. Unfortunately, we did not collect information on having a male partner in a gang, so we were unable to corroborate some of those relationships which have been observed in U.S. settings. So overall, we saw lifetime gang involvement was high in this setting, approximately 3 to 4 times that observed in school-based surveys in the United States, but note that most of these youth are currently outside of the standard school system, living on the street and primarily homeless. History of government care was associated with gang involvement for males, and childhood sexual abuse was associated with an increased risk of gang involvement for females. Those were some of the early life events we were interested in, but we did pick up current correlates of gang affiliation, including males and female youth being more likely to perpetuate and experience physical violence respectively. So this does support previous findings in urban U.S. contexts. Just some points of discussion now. Gang prevention programs in this setting and elsewhere in Canada, you know, could use this data to address the impact of adverse childhood traumatic experiences and its possible effect on an increased risk of involvement in gang affiliations in young adulthood, as well as address ongoing sexual and physical violence risks that are associated with current membership in gang activities. We do have a number of limitations that I wanted to mention and highlight. The cross-sectional nature of the study design precludes inferring causal relationships between this factor. We are conducting ongoing study in the prospective cohort to identify longitudinal associations. And as I noted, we had low power to detect some associations around females, and we're doing some qualitative work with gang-involved youth now to look at some of the issues around sexual and physical violence in more depth. And ultimately, further research will be required, I think, to develop evidence-based gang prevention programs in Vancouver and elsewhere in Canada, particularly for out-of-school youth, given that the majority of programs are focused for youth who are actively involved in the public school system in Canada. And this is certainly a population that is at high risk of gang affiliation and outside of that setting. So I wanted to finish by acknowledging the participants of our study and frontline staff who do wonderful work, and the administrative and research support at the British Columbia Centre for Excellence in HIV/AIDS. And the study is funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse and also the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. Thank you very much. Oh, my apologies. I should have mentioned that. We do referral-based outreach and snowball sampling. It's not a respondent-driven sampling, but participants are encouraged to refer their friends. So we have outreach workers work primarily with street youth organizations in Vancouver and then actually do canvassing on the street as well. So I think 85% of the youth are homeless or living in marginally housed situations. About 15% are living with friends or relatives, but almost all of them are living outside of the a home environment. Yes, youth receive $25 Canadian for each visit. The primary aim of the study is to look at HIV and hepatitis C incidence, so there is also serological collection in addition to the behavioral data that we collect that I presented. Yeah. Yeah, this is an ongoing issue in this area, and it really does. There's no formal consistent definition in the literature, so because of the transient nature of this population, they'll go from living on the street to living in marginally housed situations, shelters, living with friends, relatives, to apply a very strict definition of current or chronic homelessness. Living on the street misses a large population of vulnerably housed individuals. So we, for that reason, use a very loose definition, for lack of a better word, of street involvement. So you actually won't see a street involvement criteria in our eligibility criteria, but the sampling picks up a large number of people. Other studies, though, do focus specifically on youth who are living currently on the street. So ours is a capturing a little bit broader of a population. Mm-hmm.
Great. We still have a few minutes. If there are questions for any of the presenters, we'd be happy to entertain further questions.
I think this is a question for all the presenters, really. It seems like a lot of the data is based on self-report from the participants. So participants saying that they were a victim of intimate partner violence, or that they involved in a gang or used drugs, or that they had been a victim of sexual assault in an MSM relationship. So I was wondering, How is there issues with underreporting, and how much of an issue that is, and how you gain the trust of respondents to answer the questions accurately and not fear any sort of lack of confidentiality?
Can I say one? Mm-hmm. Yeah. At least, you know, our part, you know, I think I showed the slide about that sexual violence questions were using a CASI, which was assisted computer ones. Like, you know, you have a separate room where people look at the computer and they have to do that. So in that way, there still that can be biases there, but for sure that's much better than when you're taking an interview, because you're just on the computer and and that is more confidential. And then you're reading it, and then if you're not seeing anyone, you can probably, give a better answer than when somebody's, at least in our sample. So that's what I would say. But I don't know about the other one. But it's always a problem with the cross-sectional surveys.
Thank you.